Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it is a real treat and an honor to have these two ladies with us today. Barbara Butcher is going to be talking about her brand new book, What the Dead Know, learning about life as a New York City death investigator. And joining us to talk with Barbara is Patricia Cornwell, the great Patricia Cornwell, whose brand new book, Livid, or most recent book, Livid, is out in paperback recently. And let me give these a nice introduction to both of you real quick before we get started. For more than 20 years, Barbara Butcher worked for the Medical Examiner's Office in New York City. The second woman ever hired for the role of death investigator in Manhattan, she was the first to last more than 3 months. She spent day in and day out investigating double homicides, gruesome suicides, and most heartbreaking of all, underage rape victims who had also been murdered. In What the Dead Know, she writes with the kind of New York attitude and bravado you might expect from decades in the field, investigating more than 5,500 death scenes, 680 of which were homicides. Fascinating book. And in 1990, Patricia Cornwell sold her first novel, Postmortem, while working at the office of the chief medical examiner in Richmond, Virginia. An auspicious debut, it went on to win the Edgar, Creasy, Anthony, and McCavity Awards, as well as the French Prix du Roman Aventure, the first book ever to claim all these distinctions in a single year. Growing into an international phenomenon, the Scarpetta series won Cornwell the Sherlock Award for Best Detective Created by an American Author, the Gold Dagger Award, the RBA Thriller Award, and the Medal of Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters for her contributions to literary and artistic development. Today, Cornwell's novels and iconic characters are known around the world. Beyond the Scarpetta series, Cornwell has written the definitive nonfiction account of Jack the Ripper's identity, and she was just sharing some of her treasures behind there. Cookbooks, a children's book, a biography of Ruth Graham, and three other fictional series based on the characters Wynne Garano, Andy Brazil, and Captain Callie Chase. In recent years, Cornwell has been researching space-age technologies at NASA facilities, the U.S. Space Force, and Secret Service. She's visited Scotland Yard and Interpol, always keeping up with what's current. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. And you'll all be happy to know that I'm going to be disappearing from the screen. But if you have questions for either of our authors today, and by the way, I should say that Barbara very kindly signed a batch of books for us in New York, and they're on their way to us now. And if you'd like one, I'll put a link in the comments field for you. But also, go ahead and send in your questions and have fun. So I'll go ahead and disappear here.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick. And I will start. And first of all, hello, everybody out there. And thank you so much for joining us. And this person right here is one of my favorite people. And by the way, Barbara, if we had been working the Jack the Ripper case back in the day, his ass would have been grass. I mean, we would have caught him so fast. Isn't that right?
Especially
you would have. And, you know, I first met Barbara, I think it was probably about 1997. When I had a book coming out and my publisher wanted to do a photo shoot in a morgue, and it was going to be an Annie Leibovitz photo shoot. And Barbara, you were basically running the place that back then. You started about, well, listen, you won't admit it, but I remember that I knew you were running that place when I was there. So we did the photo shoot in the autopsy room at the New York Medical Examiner's office. It was after hours, which made it spookier because I was led back there in the dark. And that was when I first met you. And then it was probably about a decade later when I started doing research in New York and we got reconnected. And then I got involved with your forensic training program. So did my partner, Stacy. And we all, first number of years, we spent time together. But this person is the real deal. And I'm going to tell you what, she's astonished me with her book. This is the first book you've ever written. That's correct, right?
That's right. Except if you count some, you know, chapters on disasters and mass fatality management, stuff like that, the technical things. This is my first book.
Well, I was quite stunned. I did not expect the mastery that you have shown in the storytelling. And there's a number of reasons why all of you very kind folks who are listening right now are going to want to read this book. It's a great story about a really just a bigger than life person, this one right in front of you right now. And if you're interested in investigations and forensics, you will learn a lot from this book. It's almost like you're following Barbara around as she's saying, well, let me tell you exactly why rigor mortis does this, or let me tell you why this does that. And so, but anyway, hello. And let's start by talking a little bit about your background, Barbara, because you're the daughter of a New York City cop.
That's right. My dad was retired out as a deputy inspector. And I come from pretty much a cop family. My dad, my uncles. Yep, way back. And I wanted to be a cop, of course. But back in my day, there weren't that many women cops hired. And I wore glasses, which was a no-no. You know, they didn't have contact lenses back then. Geez, am I aging myself? Yes, I guess so. But anyway.
We won't talk about days that pre-existed the internet, will we?
No. Yeah, so I always had a love for investigation right from childhood and a weird curiosity about dead things too. One of my first gifts was a dissecting kit, and the local neighborhood kids would bring me their roadkill finds. You know, I could open up and say, well, this frog was killed by a car, and I can tell because there's tread marks across his back and his liver split. And kids be like, wow. So right from the get-go, I had a weird curiosity about what happened.
Well, let me ask you this now. Growing up with your father, the police officer, how did that shape your world? How did that make you feel good and bad about, first of all, human nature? Because I can imagine the stories he must have carried home.
You know, he used to just tell us a very general statement. He didn't go much into cases, but he'd say, Daddy was working with catching bad guys today. I caught bad guys. And I assumed, and he was stationed in Brooklyn, I think it was the 7-7 precinct. And I thought that all bad guys lived in Brooklyn. And one time when he invited all us kids to come and see his precinct, I was terrified because I thought all the bad guys were there. But he never told us that many details. One little thing happened, though, and that is that he brought home a 35 millimeter slide of a murder victim. A woman had been stabbed, and somehow that picture got into our family slide collection. So every time that we'd watch the Christmas package openings and Easter bonnet slideshow, that slide would pop in there suddenly, this poor woman laying there with a bloody handprint on her girdle.
Yeah, well, and how did the other kids take that?
Oh, they thought it was so cool. I thought it was a clue. I looked at that and I said, that handprint, that's a clue. I didn't know what a clue quite was, but I looked for them.
I have a theory that when you have what I call a real seeking mind, where you look at something and you have to try to figure out why it looks that way. I'm not sure everybody really is like that, but if you are like that, it's a gift, and it might also say it's a curse. But why don't you tell people the story about one of your early crime scenes that you actually talk about in the beginning of the book, about the hanging that some guy and that you might not be sitting here today had you not noticed something really that could have been catastrophic about that particular so-called, that suicide.
Yeah, I don't want to give the whole thing away there because that's my favorite chapter and I want people to read that first chapter, but I will tell you this, it was a booby trap suicide. A booby trap suicide is when you want to take others out with you. For instance, sometimes in bombings, there'll be the police do not go rushing in after an explosion. They have to send in the bomb squad first. And that's because they sometimes put secondary devices there to kill cops and firefighters and EMTs. So I didn't have that. As a medical legal death investigator, no one was running in before me to make sure things were safe. So there was this time when a hanging man rigged a certain kind of booby trap that could have killed me, except for the fact that I had my hand in a cast. Now, I was pissed off because my hand was in this cast when I cut a tendon with a saw. It was a stupid accident. And yet, it saved my life. I'll let you read the chapter to find out how.
Do you remember the first dead body you ever saw? First time you walked in a morgue or at a crime scene and there it was, or just a scene?
You know, I do remember when I was in PA school, physician assistant school, we went over to the morgue to learn about pathology and to see some dead bodies. And the first one I ever saw was a massively decomposed man. He was swollen and green and black. And,
oh, nobody's eating dinner right now.
No, yeah, really, I know. And I remember the pathologist standing there looking at him very carefully. He said, oh, yes, death by heart attack. I said, how did you know? He said, because if I cut him open, it's going to be very, very bad. And I don't think I want to cut him open, but the history tells me heart attack. Well, he was just teasing me. Of course, he did open him up, and it was awful. I mean, you know, you've been to the from the body farm. You know what decomp smells like. That's something that you never forget. And all this stuff about putting Vicks under your nose to block the smell. No. Nobody does that.
No, they don't. And then, in fact, actually, that the gelatin, the base of that, will trap the molecules that cause this unpleasantness. So it's a very bad idea to put something like that up your nose if you're around things like that, for those who may have that, you know, facing them one day. But I've just wondered if you remembered, you know, the way that felt. Like, I remember the very first autopsy I saw. I mean, I kept asking Dr. Fierro, Marcelo Fierro, who was my mentor and actually still is. If you're listening, Marcelo, hello. I finally got permission to go see a demo, you know, that they were going to do for the police. And I had become a volunteer police person, so I had a little bit of credibility so they could let me in the door. Well, what I remember most is when I walked through the door, I bumped into the gurney and then I saw the person on it. And for a minute, I just went kind of weak in the knees. And then we got around the table. And the only way I was ever able to deal with that all the years that I watched it is I tried to focus on what the pathologist was seeing. What is it they're looking for? To get caught up in the intrigue of a shadow of a pattern on somebody's leg that you realize might have been left by a belt, which changes the whole story right before your eyes. Or I'm sure you can tell many, many stories about this sort of thing. But did you find that you were always getting surprised by something?
Oh, sure. Every day was a fabulous learning experience. And I have to say that for all the difficulties of that job and all the heartache that comes with it, it was the absolute best job in the world because I love to learn. And I know your readers are people who love to learn, because one of my most favorite things about your books is the way you research things so deeply that we get an education in some new technology, some new forensics. And I have to tell you that I kind of copied that from you. So what I did as I was writing my stories is weave in the forensics, you know, how to tell time of death and how to calculate that. And that was how I first dealt with dead bodies, is looking upon them as a learning experience. To me, it was my duty to learn everything I could by observing them, by asking questions, so that when I did go to a murder or a suicide, I would know exactly what I was doing, that I wouldn't miss a thing. And someone once told me, take your hands off your ears and put them over your mouth. You know, learn to listen, learn to look, don't be talking, just observe.
You know, another forensic pathologist that I know once said that people forget that those who are in your position or the medical examiner's position, the coroner's position, oftentimes, you know, that for that victim, those are the last people they ever see. They're the only ones who can tell your story. And so it's so imperative to notice every detail you can, because those details are the dead speaking. You know, when you say what the dead know, it's also what the dead have to say. You know, what are they telling us? Because they'll tell you, in almost all cases, they'll tell you something if you really are fastidious and you don't give up.
That's right. Dead men do tell tales. You just have to listen. And the whole story of the death is right there on the body and in the scene, in the circumstances. And that's why I think documentation was so important, you know, taking photographs and measurements and things like that, that we could not just remember what we saw, but document it and then analyze it later. I think that my responsibility was not just to the dead, but to get them justice, but to their families as well. Those families needed justice. They needed answers. And if I screwed up, who knows what the effect could be? I was always so scared that if I missed something and it was my responsibility to see it, what happens when a case went to trial? You know, the weight of that sometimes hung heavily on me.
Yeah, I liked when you were talking about when you had a conversation, excuse me, with Dr. Hirsch, the chief medical examiner. I believe it was early on, and you talked about how should you tell if a family wants to know if somebody suffered, what do you say to them? Mm. I thought that was a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, he told me you tell the truth. And that was horrifying to me. There had been a man who died in a fire. And the family asked me, did he suffer? And I went to Dr. Hirsch and I said, what do I tell him? He said, the truth, because your word is all you have. If you even once lie to a family, everything else you say becomes suspect. Your word is your truth. Therefore, tell them what happened. There's no sense, you know, you don't have to stretch it out or make it too gory, but just tell the simple facts. Yes, he had a second degree burn on his hands and some on his legs, and they were probably painful. However, he died of smoke inhalation, which took perhaps 2 to 3 minutes. That's it. No sense elaborating on it, but that is the truth. And then the family trusts you because they know you're willing to say the hard stuff.
Well, I think that, you know, I think everything really is about the living, and people forget that. You know, I used to gripe at my publisher and say, I don't always want this to be about death, death, and more death, because my books aren't about death. They're about what living people do about death. And it's about those who are left behind and those who are going to prevent something awful happening to somebody else. It is about the living. And I think that's one thing that would surprise people, like if they would ever spend time in your office or something like that, about how much activity there is and how it can be almost a train station, as a matter of fact. I remember I used to come to your lobby and wait when you and I were going to meet about something. When I would sit on that furniture inside the lobby of the New York Medical Examiner's office, waiting for the head honcho here, I would think I might be one of the few people in the world that wants to be sitting here right now. Mm-hmm. And I was always overwhelmed. And you'd watch people coming in because they've lost somebody. And you never forget that it's about those that you might be able to bring comfort to, that you might be able to bring about some justice. And even if the truth is painful, I think they have to know. They have to know what their person went through.
Oh, absolutely. You know, a politician once said to me, I was asking for a budget increase to help identify missing persons, unidentified persons. And I said, this is really important to the public. He said, look, dead people don't vote. I said, yeah, but their families do. Every single one of them. So he kind of looked at me like, oh, I guess so. And I said, think about this. You allow people to go unidentified to Potter's Field. It's not really necessary. Some mother may be wondering for years, whatever happened to my son who went to New York? Or some husband might be waiting for his wife to come home after 10, 15 years, only to find out sometime, well, she died in New York and they buried in an unmarked grave. That's not fair. And that's the kind of thing.
Tell people about Potter's Field in New York, because not everybody knows what that is and the remarkable role your office has in that place. Because honestly, I used to tell you a long time ago, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You're down in the, you come into her office, the lower level, and you'll hear them making the pine boxes, right? Hammer, hammer, hammer. And then you tell them about all this because it really is quite remarkable.
Yeah, there's
and you've ridden on the barge before, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yes, the barge that takes the coffins across the River Styx to the to the place of the damned. Potter's Field is an island. It's called Heart Island. And since sometime in the 1860s, it's been used as a graveyard for those who are either unidentified or unclaimed. Their families don't know they're dead, or they don't really care to bury them. And some people just can't afford a funeral. So the body goes to Potter's Field and in a plain pine coffin, where it's buried in long trenches, three deep. And there are more than a million bodies on that little island. So many that at the water's edge, bones have started, you know, the erosion has washed away some of the old coffins from back in the early 1900s. And the bones start to wash into the water. Now, one of the strangest things about Potter's Field has always just boggled my mind. The captain who was in charge of the burial detail, they're buried by prisoners or used to be. And he said, look, over there on the northeast corner, that's where we bury the AIDS patients. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, yeah, we got to keep them away from the others. They're buried deep, deep, 12 feet deep over there. I said, I don't think that the dead have relations that would cause them to spread AIDS. And he said, well, you know, we don't know. So, I mean, that's the level of ignorance back then, that they literally separated dead people with HIV.
Wow.
One of the tragedies of Potter's Field, of Heart Island. But, you know, it's a strangely beautiful place. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't mind being buried there. I would kind of like
lots of friends. You be the mayor.
Exactly.
Mayor of Potter's Field. Yep. Well, when I was writing from Potter's Field, this was about the time I met you, actually. But I flew the helicopter over Heart Island, and it was just this very fortunate timing that the Rikers Island inmates were there with the barge, and they were on the island doing the burial thing, and there were guards with shotguns. And it was just so eerie to look down and to see that. But it is a strangely peaceful one, because I've flown over it a number of times, because you have the ruins of an old prison there, I think, with the smokestack that must go back way over 100 years, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely.
But that is one of the services that your office, you're involved in so many different things. And now, let's roll ahead just a little bit, because the thing that's really astonishing is when you get to the part where you're talking about 9/11, and that you started your day having your cup of coffee or whatever, and the phone rings on September 11th, 2001.
Yeah. You know, that was about I think I was on the job 10 years then. And the long string of murders and suicides and horrible accidents were really beginning to take a toll on me. I was emotionally shut down. I was too detached. I was suffering compassion fatigue, which happens to a lot of us. And I needed a little vacation. I went off to take a little rest. And then I come back to be smacked in the head by the death of nearly 3,000 people in one hideous, horrible attack. And, you know, I describe in the book standing on the pile, what they call the pile. It was millions of tons of rubble that were once offices and restaurants and shops and people's lives. And I remembered this expression that one death is a tragedy and 1,000 deaths is a statistic. But I will tell you that crawling through that burning, smoking, stinking rubble to find human remains, a finger, a rib, just a small piece of flesh, and then seeing a desk calendar that said, lunch with Jim, Tuesday at 1, or a picture of a child's elementary school graduation, or I remember a golf ball, a souvenir of a hole in one in a desk set with a pen. And suddenly, this is no statistic. Each one of these remains, each one of these items is a life, is a universe with family and friends and connections everywhere. And it just was absolutely overwhelming. It really did a number on me, quite frankly, but you know, we pushed ahead. Just the sheer energy that we had to dredge up and overcome our horror and our fear to work on the largest mass murder in U.S. history. We just kept going on adrenaline from that mission. And I remember the F-16 fighter jets going overhead, and that made me feel secure. It made me feel like, all right, we're in this together. But it was a rough time.
And a lot of people don't realize how close your office is to that site downtown. And in fact, your chief, Dr. Hirsch, responded and tell people about that and what the heroic thing he did and also the aftermath.
You know, Dr. Hirsch was a very humble man, a great gentleman, and never complained much. You know, he didn't talk much about himself, but on the day of 9/11, he and a few of my colleagues ran downtown as soon as the planes hit to set up a morgue, an emergency morgue, and collect remains and identify them and do whatever they could. And of course, what happened is the buildings collapsed on them. And for hours, I didn't know where Dr. Hirsch or my friend Diane were. All we knew was that they were lost. Strangely, they had been picked up by the wind, by the force of the blast, and were rolling across the plaza and landed under a pedestrian bridge that crossed the West Side Highway. And that protected them from the largest chunks of rubble, not all. They were both severely injured. You know, there's this legend that Dr. Hirsch sewed up his own arm, that it was gashed 14 inches and bleeding like hell, but he just took a needle and thread and sewed it up. That's not true. But yes, he was severely injured. And years later, he had an X-ray when he had pneumonia, and they found that he had broken every single one of his ribs, front and back.
Wow.
But he never complained. In fact, he was taken to New Jersey on a boat. They were rushing people out of New York, thinking the hospitals would be overwhelmed. And in New Jersey, he was quickly treated. They sewed up his arm. They gave him a cast for his ankle. It was broken. And he said, I need to get back to New York. And no one would take him, of course. It was too dangerous. He paid a guy with a private boat to get him back into New York City. And so that very afternoon, he was back at his desk at work directing the operation. He could probably, every breath probably hurt like fire, but he did it. It's the kind of guy he was.
Well, I met him several times, you know, back in the day when I would come down to see you.
He was very fond of you.
Well, thank you for that. I was very fond of him. And he's exactly as you describe in the book. I mean, he's so genteel and unassuming, almost something otherworldly about him. I mean, the first time I walked in his office and I saw all of the orchids that he took care of, you know, and here's this man with these very delicate plants that he takes care of while death is all around in the most savage, awful things, and he's tending to his orchids. And then you used to tell me he'd go home and listen to classical music and have a glass of wine, you know, just because people say, and they ask me, and I don't have anywhere near the saturation that you do of all this sort of thing. And you, but they people will say, you know, how do you think about it? Do you just put it behind you? And it's like, did it change you? And I will say, if what you see like this doesn't change you, there's something really wrong with you. Of course, I mean, I'm not the same person I was. I find that writing is a way that I can deal with it. I don't want to have all those memories and know where to place them. It'll be interesting to see what you do now that you've done your memoir, because you have this tremendous database and there's lots of stories to tell.
But well, you're absolutely right. I mean, writing about it is release. And I was so lucky to have discovered that, that I didn't realize how packed my head was with sorrow, with grief, with anger. And I mean, I don't mind saying that some of the things I wrote made me cry. You know, I'm not a big crier, you know me, maybe once a year around my birthday or something. But I was really moved by the memory of the victims and by honoring them in some way, by telling their stories. And I think that the most important thing about writing it down is summoning those people back so that they will never be forgotten. All the murder victims, all the kids that were killed, and bringing back the memory of the evil people who were the perpetrators of horrendous crimes. People shouldn't forget that the world is a good place, but there are some very evil people in it. And, you know, you and I know that. We've seen the aftermath of it. So even describing them was a sort of a relief for me, because I didn't realize just how scared I was of the evil in the world.
I'm still scared of it, but you can't take it sitting down. And what you learn to do is prevention is your best shield. Don't let anything like that get close. Do your best to prevent it. You don't want to have to deal with it. And be smart. You know, I tell people, and I'll tell all of you listening, you want a little free crime tip. If you want to know what bad guys think like, next time you go to the store or anywhere running an errand, I want you to walk through the parking lot and look at every single car through the eyes of a predator. And just look at the information people reveal about themselves, the baby shoes on the rearview mirror, the gym bag in the back seat that has a label on it with the person's name, or a vanity plate. Just if you start looking at the world as if it's looking back, you will change some of the ways that you behave because you'll be more careful. But there is no way these things don't change you. I'm glad I know. I wouldn't want to unknow what I know. Would you want to unknow it?
No. I'm proud of the way I gained this knowledge by trying to do some good in the world. And I wouldn't give it up for the world. If I got to be reborn and they said, all right, this time you know a little, maybe you can get a better job. No, I could not. This made me who I am, and that's fine with me. And you know, that's very good advice about the car, by the way. I've seen some programs on that. And one of the ways, very early on in my career, I was told how to survive this job. I was watching the autopsy of an 8-year-old girl who'd been smothered, killed. Mm. And the pathologist doing the post, Dr. Jackie Lee, I just looked at her. I said, how can you do this? How can you do this every single day and see this horror and go home and live? She said, Barbara, when you leave this place, you go surround yourself with things of beauty, with art and love and music and food, everything that's good, everything that's creative and wonderful. It's the only antidote to death and destruction and despair. She was absolutely right. Because I got to tell you that writing this book brought me to a new life. Well, I didn't realize.
But I will tell you something that's happened that you're probably not aware of, because this happened to me. In 1988, after I'd written 3 crime novels and I was working full time in the medical examiner's office, you know, in the morgue every day, 3 of them nobody wanted. And this one editor said, I called somebody, the editor, you're not supposed to call people who reject your books, but I was desperate. And I said, and she got on the phone and I said, can you just tell me what I'm doing wrong and if I should quit? Because this is the 3rd time I'd sent something to her. And she said, no, you shouldn't quit, but the main character is just kind of a jerk. And the only interesting one is that lady medical examiner. She was a minor character, Scarpetta was. But she said, the stuff you're writing about, is that what you actually see in the morgue? Buried treasure and cheated wills? No. And I said, no. And she said, well, I want to see what you see. Well, that forced me to let my creativity put a shield down. And now I had to start seeing all that stuff through a creative eye, which means that emotions come into play. And yeah. About that time, the South Side strangling cases started in Richmond, and that became the birth of postmortem. But I remember saying to myself, if I'm going to do this and make it real, then I'm going to show people what I really see, because I owe it to these people. I'm not going to sanitize it. I'm not going to make it a murder mystery, something cute. There's nothing cute about what's on that table. Mm-hmm. So you will find that's going to change a lot of your emotional settings, because you've let your creativity, because your descriptions are really, they're like a novel. You know, you've got a real eye for detail.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I remember your first book, Postmortem. When I read that, I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I still don't like to think about, well, I won't give away the plots for people who haven't read it. But anyway, I think you're right. The creativity and giving birth to something is the opposite of death. So giving birth to a book, it helped me push death away for a little bit.
What you've done is give life to things that were ruined. You give life to them. When you talk about any of these cases that you are describing in your book, you are bringing them back, and you're actually giving them an existence they never had before. And so that's a really amazing thing to get to do. And it's a gift and it's a pleasure, even though it's painful. Another thing I want people to know about you is, tough as you are, because I know how tough you are, but I also know how kind you are. And when I would be hanging around the office and we'd be walking somewhere to get a coffee or a bagel, and the Bellevue Hospital across the street, which became homeless shelter, as I recall, and you'd have these people walk, you know, these homeless people, Barbara be stopping and she's talking to all of them, and they know her name and she knows their name. I said, what are you, the damn mayor? I always was aware of that gentleness, where you always looked people in the eye and you treated them like you saw them and they mattered to you. And some people might think that those who deal with the dead all the time don't care about the living. That's just not true. Not all of us anyway.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I do remember those guys who, they hung around out in the front of our building because we had scaffolding up. Mm-hmm. And permanent scaffolding, since the building is falling down. And these guys just needed a place to get out of the rain or get out of the sun. And they'd just be like 12 guys hanging around on the railings. And once in a while, I'd say, you know, who wants to make 10 bucks today picking up the trash out of the bushes here? And I got to know them. And they were just people who were the subject, who were the victims of misfortune. You know, not everybody got the breaks like I got. I've been extremely lucky all my life. And I'd love to spread some of that luck around. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is for my colleagues, the people who work now as medical legal death investigators, as first responders, the cops, the firemen, the EMTs, and then the last responders like me. We go through a lot. We see things that other people don't see. We deal with horror that we don't want anyone else to have to face. And it has an effect. It takes a toll on all of us. And back in my day, you know, if you said, oh, I wonder if we need some kind of psychological help, nah, get the hell out of here. We're strong people. We can do this job. And that was, you know, that's the way it was. It was a boys' network. And nowadays, I think everyone's beginning to recognize the terrible toll on our emotions for first responders and last responders. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book. You know, I tell what happened to me, and it wasn't pretty. But,
well, you're a survivor, and your story, you have tremendous courage to be as honest as you have been in this book. And I won't give much away, but just suffice it to say that what you see is what you get. You told it straight the way it was. And that takes a lot of guts, a lot of courage. And it's very inspirational, because you're very successful. I mean, it's after Dr. Hirsch was injured and all that, in many ways, you began running the place, doing a lot of things, that like going to meetings with the mayor that he didn't want to go to. And here you are sitting down across from Bloomberg. And so you know, you're tremendously successful, and people would look at you as very powerful, and it will mean a lot to them to see that you've had times that are very dark, and somehow you've made it.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Dr. Hirsch was famous for hating meetings, hating politics. All he wanted to do was his forensic medicine. So he was all too glad to let me run things and let me go to meetings and go to budget hearings and be berated by city councilmen and these folks, so that he could tend to the education of the future medical examiners, to the families of the deceased. So yeah, I was pretty lucky in doing that. And also, I think it came at a time, that promotion, when I was just about to burn out for good, when full compassion fatigue was coming down hard on me. Being in the streets, investigating deaths, it was just killing me. So a desk jockey job and dealing with mayors, that was nothing compared to being out on the streets. But you know who I miss so much is the cops. I mean, you've worked with hundreds, thousands of police officers and detectives as you've done all your research and for your books. You know what good people they are. For the most part, I mean, there's always a bad apple somewhere in every one of our professions, including writers. But these folks, they go out there and they protect us. And I miss being with them. I miss the humor, the dark humor. And I just miss that feeling of protection of being around a bunch of big cops with guns. You
know? I kind of like that too. That I appreciate it. But, you know, I agree with you. If you've worked with these people, while we all know from the news that there are some horrible people out there that abuse their power in every profession, including law enforcement. But my experience, by and large, these people have been my heroes over the decades that I've been so privileged to get to work with them and ride around with them and shoot the breeze about what might have happened in this, and you know, investigation or this case. And and these people, just as you talked about some of the tragedies that have happened with those people that you worked with, I remember very early on when I was working, you know, in Richmond at the Emmy's office, and I was driving to the morgue this particular morning, and I was listening to the local radio station, and it talked about this particular detective who had committed suicide the night before. And this was a guy I used to ride with, I rode with all the time. And so here I am hearing that when I get to work, he's going to be, you know, in the building. So I went into he was in the x-ray room on the table, and I went in there and I shut the door. He had just a little teeny bullet hole in his chest, and that was the end of it. And the reason he did this is that he had been working the Southside strangling cases, and it had burned him out so badly, he just went haywire. And so one night he just yelled at his wife, "I can't take this anymore," picked up he had an early 9mm, picked it up, went boom. And as I was in the room with him with the door shut, I said, "I don't know why you did this." I said, "I wish you hadn't done this, but I'm here." And I chatted with him for a minute, so to speak, and then I went back into my office, which was upstairs, and I shut my door and just stayed in there all day doing my computer work and didn't want to talk to anybody. And I, you know, you don't even know how to process things like that.
Yeah.
And how fragile things are. But on a positive note, before we get to some questions, because we probably need to do that soon, let me just say this. One of the things that can be so good about exposure to all this, I swear to goodness, for me, it makes me really want to find the good in people. I don't want to be looking at the bad. I know it's there. I see it if it crosses the room, but I want to see the good. We need to celebrate the good and empower it, and all of us be part of that.
That's right. Celebrate the beauty.
And thank you for this wonderful book you've done, Barbara. You guys got to read it. You're going to love it.
Thank you, Patricia. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
There are some questions here, but I just wanted to chime in just for a moment. And in this book, I mean, it really is, I don't know if Patricia would agree, but there is a lot of the hero's journey in this book, you know, the classic story of the inner journey as well as the outer, you know, going down into the underworld, you know, and coming up from that period of disillusionment and despair that is such a big part of the hero's journey. To some sort of restoration, And I just wanted to ask you about Barbara F. Butcher and Associates.
Well, now, you see, my name is actually Barbara A. Butcher. But when I lost my job, when a new mayor came in, you know, the politicians get to change everybody around. And when I lost my job, I was so angry. I mean, they stole my career, my identity.
It wasn't fair.
Mm-mm. Just wasn't fair. And so when I decided, fuck the hell with them, I'm going to start my own company. And it's going to be Barbara Effin Butcher. And that is my company. And I'm going to get the best and the brightest people working with me. And we're going to work for families and solve crimes and do all kinds of wonderful things. And then something happened, you know, I crashed. You'll see when you read the book, but yeah, it was, I had great intentions, but I still kept that name for my consulting company, Barbara F. Butcher.
I think as you should.
That's right.
Okay. So some of the questions Dot would like to know, I was wondering if Barbara has any thoughts on the Harvard Medical School body parts.
Yes. How about disgusting, despicable, to just in every way, evil and nasty and rotten. You know, when a person dies, all their family has left to put closure to it is to bury their body, to have the ceremonies of closure. And to violate that, to mutilate somebody or to steal from their body is beyond despicable. I can't imagine it.
Let's see. What kind of training would you recommend for a young person just starting out in your field?
You know, back in my day, you had to be a physician or a physician assistant. Now they're looking more for forensic science degrees, forensic anthropology, forensic DNA, trace evidence training, because you can take anyone with a scientific background and with the right on the job training, you can make them into a good investigator, but you need that science background. Now,
I was going to say that don't ever underestimate your ability to be self-taught. I mean, there are things that you can read, you can go on. There's so much available on the internet that wasn't available when you and I were getting started, Barbara. We had to go haul these big old textbooks around and whatever, but there is, if you want to learn something badly enough, take it from me, because I'm an English major. You know, I'm not a physician's assistant. I didn't work as a death investigator. I'm not a medical examiner, but I'm self-taught. And I continue to do that, just as I'm sure you are, because technologies change, and that means the crimes change. Like now we live in the world of cyber crimes. Well, people get murdered because of cyber crimes. I mean, everybody, all of us involved have to know about this, these sorts of things.
You're absolutely right. I mean, some of the best information, and you have to know how to sort through information, of course, as you do, is online. For so many, forensics changes so quickly. You can't go around with Spitz and Fisher anymore or the other big textbooks. They change within a week or two.
Patricia, was the Jack the Ripper case kind of a gateway to getting involved in this or interested in forensics, or did that come later?
No, the Ripper came much later. When I graduated from college in the Stone Age, my first job was at the Charlotte Observer, and I got the police beat. And I was like 23 years old or 22. And that was my first exposure to crime. And I remember the homicide scenes or death scenes I would go to, and the police would never tell me what happened to the body after it was whisked away. And so roll ahead. Living in Richmond, moving there in 1981, I decided I was going to try to write books about crime because I did a biography and then I wanted to do novels. And so I went to the medical examiner's office, met Marcella Fierro. She gave me a tour. She said if I wanted to really spend some time there, I needed to be credible. So why don't you become a volunteer police officer? So I did that. If you look behind me, you can see my police hat from way back in those days. Mm-hmm. When I would direct traffic and do really important things like take dog bite reports. Then I did postmortem that came out in 1990. So the Ripper was about a decade later And I won't bore everybody with it, but suffice it to say, I was exposed to some things about it. And I started thinking, why has nobody tried to look at the evidence in this case?
Wow. So you were a recovering English major?
I'm still a recovering English major. Ain't that nice?
Me too. Me too. Let's see here. Okay. Oh, well, we've had a number of people suggest the natural collaboration between the two of you. Have you thought about
working? We are such trouble if we get together.
Oh, yeah.
I was saying to Barbara, my God, if Scarpetta had run into you earlier, I wouldn't bother writing any books because there'd be everything would be solved in 5 minutes. I'd be so, why bother? There's no point. You know, so I don't know. We should do something. We'll have to figure that out, Barbara. We have a lot to say if people are interested.
You know, we had some good ideas back then, too, and we'd be like tromping around through the morgue and we'd talk about things like how much fun it would be to get a little team together and go out and solve cold cases, go across the country to the smaller jurisdictions that didn't have the resources we did, and how we could, you know, direct a team of anthropologists, fingerprint DNA people, and what a great time we'd have doing that. You know something? I still think about it.
Maybe what we should do sometime is talk about the two of us talk about a real case that there are questions about. Yeah. And we both will weigh in on what we think, you know.
I think so.
And the difference between me and you is if you're right, I can just lie and make up something and say that you're wrong because I write fiction. So I would have a decided advantage in this situation.
By the way, Barbara, you have a wonderful voice, a wonderful speaking voice. Have you done the audio book, I hope?
Yes, I did the audio book and it was so much fun. I like acting. That was my first hobby after I lost my job. And I took a few acting lessons. So when I got to do the audio book, I really enjoyed the hell out of it. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do all the different accents. And they said, no, back up just a little bit there, Barbara. We don't need you to, you know, do everybody's voices and all that. But it was a lot of fun. I had a great time.
Well, yeah, I remember the time I audited your death investigation school in New York, and she's the MC. I mean, she was up there telling everybody what was going on. I mean, you were like the Vanna White of the Wheel of Death. I mean, you were just amazing dancing around up there. And you have to go to something like this to believe how surreal it is. I remember this one question, this woman stood up. She said, I was just elected district attorney and blah, blah, podunk. And I didn't realize that part of the job is I'm also the coroner. She said, how do you tell someone's dead other than holding a mirror in front of their face? And I said, oh boy. And that was some of the people that you were teaching.
I remember that very well, that very woman. She's like, oh, I just found out I'm the coroner too. You know, people should know, there's something people should know about you, Patricia. You're not just a writer, that you are a supporter of law enforcement, of forensic science. And, you know, speaking of our Forensic Academy, I got a grant some years ago from NIJ to start a forensic academy at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. And it was a pretty good grant. We had enough money to bring in people from all over the country to learn from the best. But I didn't have money to pay the teachers. And when Patricia and I were hanging around and I told her about my school, I said, you know, I don't have enough money. And I gave her kind of like a look like that. And she said, well, I could help you out. I said, really? Really? What could you do? And she named a figure that knocked me back in my seat. And for the 6 years that that course ran, she came to nearly every one of the big annual courses and signed books for people and put on dinners for these investigators and cops from all around the country and paid the salaries of the teachers. And she made it possible for, I think it was the number, I tried to research it today. It was something like 860 people, coroners and cops from around the country to attend our course, the Cornwell Scholarships. So people should know that about you. You never publicized it. You know, it's just one of those.
That's just simply an honor when I can give back. I mean, I wouldn't know anything if people like you hadn't been teaching me from day one. I mean, I got a free education. It just was a price to pay, but not money. But people who have been like you, who've been so generous, and Dr. Fierro, who I still use, I'll call her up with these absurd questions about something that, you know, because I'm always coming up with wild ideas. And So if I can help educate other people or just show respect that I don't take it lightly that people have been so helpful and continue to be so helpful to me.
Well, you certainly paid it back a thousandfold. Thank you for that.
Try.
Yeah, Peggy says, all your stories are gifts and inspiration to young women growing up. Thank you. Have a number of nice comments like that.
You know, all stories are gifts, period. It's just really what you're saying, Barbara, about giving people stories. I used to think that the saddest thing in the world is to look at someone and no one's ever told their story. It's sort of like looking at a skeleton and knowing that no one can call that person by name because they don't know who it is. We all have a story and it deserves to be told.
That's right. That's right.
Here's a really interesting comment. Have you ever paused while at a crime scene and wondered about the ones who will be cleaning everything up?
Actually, no, because I knew who they are. There are services that, in fact, one of my colleagues started a little cleaning company. I think he called it, You Kill Them, We Clean Them, something awful, some terrible name. I said, Jules, you got to change that name right away. But they would clean up crime scenes because, you know, the biological contaminants, bloods and decomp fluids are pretty awful. So, they'd use all kinds of special chemicals and put on those Tyvek suits and scrub it down. So I knew what happened.
Yeah. And not to mention those who are left behind, you don't want to leave them to have to deal with something like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much that goes into all this that a lot of people just don't know about. And there's so many unsung heroes of people who are the ones cleaning up that stuff and trying to be kind to the family that's waiting to get back, you know, all these things that you don't think about when you hear about a case of violence somewhere.
Yeah. It takes a big team of people to clean up the aftermath of terrible crimes.
Let's see. Nicholas asks, are either of you aware of any new technology or methods to help solve cold cases, such as recreating an image of a suspect's face using genealogy and DNA analysis?
Sure. I mean, it's in its infancy still. I mean, to me, the greatest new tool is genetic genealogy. I absolutely love it. And if I were a little younger and had time to start another career, that's probably what I'd do. I love it. I think it's a fantastic way to, you know, expand out DNA use in crime, criminal identifications. And the use of forensic anthropologists now can use skeletal remains to sculpt or reconstruct a face. And that helps us identify crime victims. You know, don't forget, of the approximately 26,000 unidentified bodies that are laying around coroner's offices and medical examiner's offices across this country, so many are victims of crimes, and you can't investigate that crime and you can't catch a perpetrator until you know who the victim is. So this is the time to do, you know, victim identification, where we really got to push forward with the technology.
Well, that genealogical stuff is amazing because, you know, we're going to get to a point where everything's connected anyway. And you're going to find that somebody's connected maybe way, you know, three cousins removed, but it's a map that begins to lead maybe in the right direction when you've got no idea about who this person is or who did it.
That's right.
Actually, an interesting question for both of you regarding the, you know, those 23andMe kind of companies. I know at least several crime novels have dealt with this and kind of I think Michael Connelly, one of his books, dealt with a criminal who is exploiting, you know, some of these gene databases and how they're not, at least at the time, they weren't regulated properly. And do you know much about that? Is that changing or?
I don't know much about it. I couldn't speak to it.
I just know that any technology like that is going to be exploited by bad people as well as good. Anything that can be used for good, the bad people are going to try to defeat it or use it for their purposes. And so, you know, that's just the way it always goes. It's the same thing with artificial intelligence. At the same time that people are trying to use it, you know, that GPT-4 chatbot thing to answer questions about law or medicine or who knows what, you have bad people who are trying to make artificial intelligence malware, you know, teaching it bad things. And so, you know what you have to do? You just got to keep moving on and doing the right thing, because there's always going to be bad people that want to do the wrong thing.
Yeah. And speaking of that artificial intelligence stuff, somebody pirated my book. They took my real book, fed it into an AI machine or whatever the hell it is, and rewrote it as the biography of Barbara Butcher. And it's on sale.
Oh my God.
It's a terrible, terrible book.
I hope your publisher's doing something about that.
Yeah, they're working on it now. But it's the kind of thing where it says, Barbara Butcher was born in the little town of Essex, a sweet and beautiful town where she was drawn to the darkness of death. I'm like, what the hell kind of stuff is that? Well, it's a computer.
Is that like the little golden book of your...
Yeah.
Well, we're up against problems, the likes of which we've never seen with all this, but you can't put that genie back in the bottle. And I'm hoping that AI will actually prove to be more good than bad. I'm always hopeful about technology, but you know, there are new things all the time that are going to help catch people. And I'm looking forward to what else is next.
We just got to stay ahead of the bad guys.
That's right.
Job security, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's a cause. It's job security, but it's what everybody should be doing. Everybody should be trying to stay a step ahead of the bad guys, so to speak. And we can do it.
Yeah. That's really interesting, Patricia, what you were saying earlier about, you know, kind of switching your perspective and looking at it from the perpetrator or the predator's perspective. We have a lot of comments about, you know, people weighing in about that. And I know we're running out of time here, but there are a few comments about PTSD and about how, you know, heck, we didn't even have a, you know, much of of the vocabulary to talk about it until, what, 30 years ago, something like that. And as it relates to first and last responders, do you think there are a lot of first and last responders who have suffered burnout and simply left the field?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know in my field, there were plenty of folks that, you know, good investigators, caring investigators who left because they just couldn't take the emotional load of it anymore. And they went off to do, I remember one went to work for a plastic surgeon, make people pretty. Another, she went to work in the cosmetic industry. Again, make people pretty, do something nice instead of look at dead folks. Yeah, lots of people burn out. A lot of police officers burn out early. Just
I can certainly see that. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I tell you, but I remember one thing that Dr. Fierro said to me once. You were talking about decomposed bodies, and we'd had a floater, as we call it. And she and I were going down the elevator, and the, you know, the foulness was wafting up, and we're going down this elevator. And I was going to scribe for her while she did the case. And I looked at her and I said, sometimes I don't know how you do this, because it was going to be really disgusting. And she said, I just tried to see him for who he was before this happened. And suddenly I saw this man out in a boat on the James River with his little boy fishing. And, you know, you could see the shorts and the sandals and the whatever, because that's what happened. He fell overboard because he had a heart attack. They didn't find him for a while. But I suddenly had this image of this beautiful day, this beautiful moment. And that's what got me through being down there, is I tried to see him for who he was before this terrible tragedy and indignity, I might add, where you would say, please excuse my dust, only it's worse than dust right now.
Good point. It's a great point.
Wow. Well, we have a great comment, which is probably a good note to wrap up on. Phyllis says, no question, just sending hugs and admiration to you both.
I know who that is. That's my favorite screenwriter, I have a feeling. Phyllis Nash, big kisses and hugs.
Thank you. That's lovely.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah, thank you, everybody, for being here. This was great.
Here's the latest books here, and go out and get them. Thanks so much. Really appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. Thanks.
Thank you, Barbara. We'll be talking soon.
Great.
Barbara, would you mind sticking around just for a second while
sure.
I Yeah, thank you. All right, thanks so much for tuning in, everybody.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.